content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we left off last time in the chapter on adulthood, which is July and August. And our topic today is fetid but fantastic Euchymis. Give me a plant that looks otherworldly for many weeks, but is happy to sit in its pot, dry and sleeping, in my cellar all winter, here in Zone 5B, which is New York. Remember that. It's not North Carolina. Asking nothing. Give me Euchymis, the pineapple lily, and the bigger and odder the better. The only bad thing I have to say about some of these hyacinth relatives, whose genus name means well-haired or lovely-haired, because of the crown-like tuft of bracts topping the flower head. Some smell bad, like something died, or like they're related to voodoo lilies, but they're not. Blame the sulfur compounds in the scent of the most common ones, Euchymis bicolor, chemicals aimed at attracting carrion flies. If you're a flower needing to reproduce and survive, you had better appeal to the right insect, however. Color, maybe, or flower shape, or scent. Smelling like a dead body is the secret in E. bicolor's case. Thankfully, some others, like Euchymis cumosa, are sweet-smelling or scentless. The fetid ones didn't stop me, and I grew medium-sized E. bicolor for years before declaring it the start of a collection and added others. You know where that led. No more room on the basement floor for any more pots. Choices included descendants of 10-inch-tall Euchymis vandermeerii, the dwarf pineapple lily, with offspring like octopus, barely 6 inches high, and the tiny piney types. To others with E. palidiflora genetics, the well-named giant pineapple lily, which I learned from the Pacific Bulb Society, includes subspecies with flowers to 6 feet at maturity. I adopted a big pot simply labeled giant pineapple lily, and it topped 3 feet the first year, with white blooms and lusty green foliage. John Treasure, with purplish flowers and tinged foliage, got to 30 inches. Next, I prowled for more little guys and others with dramatic, darker foliage, such as sparkling burgundy, which Tony Avant selected in 1983, and more recently Rhode Island Red from Ed Bowen of Rhode Island, close to 3 feet with pink flowers and maroon-green leaves, or petite, very purple, dark star. The bulb's age and growing conditions will affect the height of the flower or whether you get flowers at all. Many Euchymis species come from areas in South Africa that offer summer rain, so I offer sun and don't deprive them moisture once up and growing. But I am careful to avoid waterlogging as if a saucer were beneath them. I like everything about pineapple lilies. Well, except maybe that occasional smell. I like the lush leaves, the stems, which can be dark colored or freckled too, and even the showy seed heads after the long-lasting flowers are gone. Unless you adopt euchymus from a nursery that sells them potted and growing, you'll wait until spring to order more, since loose bulbs are not sold in fall. Many euchymus are hardy to about zone 7, with e-bicolor catalogs often say zone 6 if deeply planted and well mulched in early spring. But otherwise, there is not much to do except wait for their welcome, though often late, reawakening. And those are our zones. 7 and 6 are our zones in North Carolina. So it's still a good flower for North Carolina, if you like it. And our next topic is Southeast Native, Northeast Garden. It felt like such a big score the day decades ago when I found bottle bush buckeye, Aeschylus parviflora, in a nursery in New Bedford, Massachusetts, even though the plant was just a small thing in a plastic pot. Now it's my biggest shrub and also a treasure for its hummock-shaped handsome leaves that turn impressively gold in fall and easy, basically disease-free disposition. Pollinators agree it's a winner when it covers itself in creamy bottle brush flowers in July. I had only seen a bottle bush buckeye once at the public garden called Wave Hill in New York City, a giant suckering mound of a thing, some probably 20 feet across and 10 feet high. It grew in the semi-shade of tall trees, as it does in its natural habitat of the southeastern United States, specifically the rich woodlands in Alabama, Georgia, and northern Florida. I loved its big mountain of a presence right away, and then on that shopping trip to Alan Haskell's former nursery, there it was. But why is this southeastern native hardy up here? And come to think of it, why are several of my other most prized woody plants likewise labeled as southeastern natives, but so well adapted, including Fothergilla gardeniae, an F major, Chionanthus virginicus, the super fragrant fringe tree, Oxydendrum arboreum, the small tree called sourwood, and Hydrangea quercifolia, the oak leaf hydrangea. Apparently, regional boundaries of the pre-Pleistocene era weren't quite as we perceive them now. As transformative glaciers expanded over more of a cooling continent, paleontologists say that forest plants from the northeast took refuge farther south, and in the CA 12,000 years since, some haven't regained their former ranges. The details are not fully understood, but it's not just here either. One of the most extreme examples I was told by Peter Crane, former director of the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, was about the ginkgo and went back a couple of hundred million years. Today we think of ginkgo as having just one species, the Chinese G. biloba, but fossil records of pollen indicate that ginkgo was once native in places as diverse as Afghanistan, northern England, and North Dakota. Though from a distance, Aeschylus flowers appear to be cream-colored, each tiny one on the long wands, technically panicles, is delicately splashed with drops of orange-red paint. Actually, the red antlers and pinkish filaments inside the little trumpets. Butterflies and many insect pollinators love to visit them, including silver-spotted skippers and the occasional group of Baltimore Orioles, who explore them enthusiastically as they do earlier apple and wild cherry blossoms. After many years, my Aeschylus started producing an occasional crop of nuts that delighted local chipmunks and squirrels, but are reported poisonous to humans or livestock. I now have multiple bottle bush buckeye plants too, including the later blooming Rogers, a selection from A. parviflora var serotonina. It's slightly larger with very large flower stems, about 30 inches long, and blooms a couple of weeks after the species, so there is a longer season of Aeschylus for us all to enjoy, and more of the giant mounds of fall gold. In warmer zones, like its native range, planting bottle bush buckeye is in shade to part shade is recommended, and it does well in shady spots here too, or in sun, where the plants get bigger and flowers flower more heavily. The only disclaimer I have to offer is, give it serious room. And our next topic is weavers and see-throughs. A professional gardener visited a renowned public garden known for its effusive plantings and unexpected combinations. Upon returning home, her boss asked her how she had enjoyed the place. "I didn't really like the way that all the plants touched," she said, apparently having missed the point. In a good, established garden, no plant is an island, and the mulch isn't meant to be the focal point. Many gardeners would offer money to make the plants touch faster rather than waiting 2 to 5 years, longer with woody things, for that mature, filled-in look a garden gets if you stick with it. I am one of them. One functional class of plant that helps make this happen a little faster and a lot more romantically is something referred to as weavers. Weavers' natural habit is not some tidy, perfect mound, but rather to reach out and touch their neighbors, or even wrap their arms around them. When I think of weavers, I immediately think of what baby's breath does in a traditional bouquet. White-flowered Asteromia mongolica, the Japanese aster, would be an especially effective way to accomplish that in a border, and is a more cooperative grower with longer bloom. In my late season garden, this effect is created by some of the cloud-like, low to medium height native asters with small flowers, such as the calico aster I know as Aster lateriflorus, especially the cultivar Lady in Black, and the heart-leaved aster, S. cardifolium. Such asters are among my favorite weavers because by the time they flower in fall, you really need something to tie the tired garden together, some of which you may have had to cut back. In shadier spots, the white wood aster, Eurybia divaricata, does the job. Notia macedonica is another weaver, not because it has tiny cloud-like flowers, they are bigger and vivid crimson, but because it is inclined to flop here and there and combine with other plants in an appealing way. You get the idea. Some of the looser perennial geraniums, like Anne Folkard or Roseanne, scramble around nicely, knitting while they go. And I use geranium aphanium, such as the variety Samabor, with a distinctive dark purple blotch on the foliage, as effective filler, even in semi-shade. Often overlooked are the shorter stature non-vining clematis, like Clematis recta. Seek the purple-leaved ones, like lime close, lately marketed as Sirius black, which will scramble happily through the other inhabitants of a perennial bed or shrubbery instead of up a trellis, making a froth of ivory flowers at maybe 5 or 6 feet maximum height. Cutting lime close to the ground and after bloom will yield a fresh flush of that gorgeous purple foliage. Clematis durandi with purple flowers and other members of the integrifolia group are especially good for scrambling duty, with the potential for longer bloom season, too. Another class of plants named for their useful habit in designing are sometimes called see-throughs, taking up little room on ground level, but instead giving an airy appearance up above. Tall verbena is the classic see-through, a self-sowing annual in my climate. Its tall, wiry stems seem to come up out of nowhere, supporting flattened clusters of tiny purple flowers that make ideal landing pads for colorful butterflies. It blooms from midsummer till hard frost for me, from hefty seedlings set out in May, or once established and allowed to do its thing, the many self-sown start their bloom a little later. Some tall alliums are like that in springtime. Virtually no mass at ground level, with spectacular blooms on high that seem to float. And our next topic is insect love, or at least respect. I propose a moratorium on killing insects that the gardener is not on a first-name basis with, ones we have not at least taken the time to key out and identify using bugguide.net or a field guide to be sure they are actually a foe. Resist the wish to squish. Please do your homework and in the process get to know the little things that run the world, as Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson referred to invertebrates, including insects. Attend the moratorium to all spiders who occupy an order within the second largest class of arthropods after insects, the arachnids. No matter how visceral the case of arachnophobia might be, never harm a spider, the leading insect predator without whom the world might be uninhabitable. Why do we rush to crush everything on 6 or 8 legs, or revile those on many more, like the giant millipede? A detritivore, whose essential job is to recycle debris at ground level. All too often, gardeners are revolted by the sight of a caterpillar, for example, and move to exterminate these seemingly voracious eaters. But how many beside the tomato hornworm or gypsy moth or Colorado potato beetle or eastern tent caterpillar, perhaps, do you really know by name or can identify? Do you know their favored diet and who eats them? Without caterpillars during nesting season, songbird parents would lack the highest quality baby food their clutches rely on to fledge and thrive. In adopting an attitude of curiosity about insects, I have come to marvel at how many have evolved to take an aposematic coloration, a warning color pattern, and perhaps even a suite of behaviors that potential predators understand on an innate or learned level are dangerous, and look for something else to eat. The monarch caterpillar and its adult butterfly is the famous example, but have you noticed how many other insects, locust borers, syrphid flies, or hover flies, or the snowberry clear-wing sphinx moth, to name several, mimic bees' yellow and black coloration? Birds, who presumably would happily eat them, might not innately know the bees are dangerous. But after sampling one bee, studies have shown that birds such as blue jays will never eat something furry and yellow and black again. Don't misunderstand. After careful identification, I am all for hand-picking alien insects that are confirmed true pests, like squash bugs and Japanese beetles, or imported or cross-striped cabbage worms, or brown marmorated stink bugs. Oh, I know those ones. I've seen those. Better yet, I am all for examining the undersides of the leaves of some pest's favorite crops each morning with my 3 middle fingers wrapped in duct tape, sticky side out, a kind of insect egg lint brush, at the ready for easy removal duty. Get them before they hatch and with a non-toxic mechanical intervention. One August, years ago, a lot of little fuzzy black and white creatures were eating the canna leaves, which is what got me started wondering who's who. It was the larva formed of a hickory tussock moth, whose usual diet is ash, elm, oak, hickory, maple, willow, and other trees. I learned so much from this visitor, whom I have greeted every August since. Though he is furry, look but don't touch. The long lashes are hollow tubes connected to poison glands, and touching the bristles, called setae, can give susceptible people a stinging nettle-like rash. The tussock moths are cousin to the familiar woolly bear, and in the taxonomic subfamily Arctilinia, the tiger moths, since they're not deforesting the entire region or anything, I just let them be and eat. And I even clean up less obsessively in fall with such a lepidopterian well-being in mind. Many beneficial species at various life stages overwinter in places like leaf litter. We just don't understand enough about nature's tiniest creatures to go blindly rampaging against them, do we? And our next topic is, and I don't think we'll have too much time. I'll start this topic again in the next podcast as well. Foliage, the garden's wardrobe. I frankly shop for leaves, most of all, not flowers. So I bristle when I see charts of perennials or shrubs where they list just name, height, bloom time, and flower color. Why isn't there a column about the leaves? Flowers alone do not a garden make, since they represent the reproductive portion of the plant's life cycle, a mere moment in its year. And there we go on here. It looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and we will continue with that topic in our next podcast, so please join us. Thank you.